psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, the voice you trust for the family you love.
And so I realized that he wanted counsel to teach me. He wanted counsel to help me overrun that fear that I had.
It's a sad commentary on today's families that there are so many children that are deprived of love.
And finally you said, listen to what? And I held the phone down and Lincoln was screaming and you said, I'm a grandpa.
This is Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson, along with Ryan Dobson and Luann Crane.
Well, of course, yesterday was the 4th of July, a huge celebration in honor of this great nation, and I hope all of you are still enjoying a long weekend, which makes me wonder, why are we not enjoying that long weekend? Why are we here?
Well, we're going to, Ryan. That barbecue will be fired up at our house at least later today. In fact, I happen to have heard, not from you, that you got a new grill gadget for Father's Day a couple of weeks ago. So yeah. I'm sure you're going to put that into service this afternoon.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, it's so important to capitalize on holidays like this, not just for the fun and the good food and the fellowship, but to commemorate our nation's history. We even devoted last Friday's program, Luann, to a very intentional time of educating families on exactly what some of the crucial elements have been related to America's birth.
That was with our good friend David Barton. He is one of the best historians I know out there. If anybody missed that, they can go to myfamilytalk.com and listen later today. In fact, I was thinking that would be a great piece to play as you're sitting around the fire pit tonight with your family.
Great idea. Yeah. But as an extension of that very concept, this whole idea of passing our great heritage down to the next generation, which I feel is extremely important, you know, and to help our kids understand the cost, the sacrifice that thousands of men and women have made to ensure that our freedoms endure in this country. There's no better way to do that than to tell a story.
And so, knowing you, I bet you've got one.
You can be sure of that, Ryan. I'd like every American citizen to know about the bravery and the sacrifice of a certain Navy veteran from the Vietnam War, Admiral Jeremiah Denton. Before going on to represent his state of Alabama in the United States Senate, he had an incredible experience, a horrible experience, in Vietnam as a prisoner of war for 7.5 years. He was locked behind bars in enemy hands with over half of that time spent in solitary confinement. I can't even imagine that. And while his wife and kids were back here in the United States growing up without him, he was suffering in that way. It was an enormous sacrifice for this country that he loved, and I know he doesn't really like to be called a hero, but I'm telling you, Jeremiah Denton is one.
But I'm afraid as the years go by and as people forget the Vietnam War and that becomes a distant memory, I'm glad you took the time, Dad, to sit down with him a while and get his story captured on tape. So let's now hear that conversation with a true American hero, Admiral Jeremiah Denton, on Family Talk with you, Dr. James Dobson.
Before we hear it, let me just add that this recording was made in 1983, and I was moved by it then, and I believe our listeners will be today. I know you've been interviewed on the subject many times before, but I'd like you to tell your story one more time for those that have perhaps not heard it. I'm, of course, speaking of what you wrote about in your book, When Hell Was in Session. Let's go back to 1965, when you were on a bombing mission in North Vietnam, and tell again what happened.
Well, it was a relatively important mission against the target that was then most heavily defended outside of Moscow, a very important bridge called the Than Hoa Bridge over the Ma River in North Vietnam. And I was leading the strike of 28 aircraft against that bridge. And as I released my bombs, I was hit, lost control, and the rest of my hydraulics as I pulled out at a relatively low altitude. There's no alternative to hydraulics, and no secondary hydraulic system in the A6, so we ejected and I was captured as I landed in the Ma River after attempting to escape. These two scars on my neck are where I was hit with a machete as I tried to battle off my captors.
Hmm. So you were captured and you were injured. What'd they do with you, and how'd they treat you?
Well, I was in and out of consciousness for the first few days, either from loss of blood or shock. I don't know which. They kept giving me blood transfusions. I lost a lot of blood from the machete cuts when these guys hit me with a machete.
I understand from the book that you were the first prisoner, American prisoner, in American history to be put in solitary confinement for the period of time that you were.
That's what I was told, that I was the first of several there. I think there were about five of us who eventually reached 4 years. I got 4 years earlier than the others.
You were confined in one little room with no contact with the outside world. Describe what that was like.
Not always in a little room. There were times I was in a room as much as, say, 16 by 16 feet, but alone. There were times in which I was in a room about as big as a freezer. I had 47 inches by 47 inches to play around in, and then a concrete bunk that was the size of that room, no window. I was in there over 2 years, about 17 hours a day of which were spent in irons. Conditions just varied as far as being utterly alone, yes. For the whole 4 years I was in solitary confinement, if you were caught trying to communicate with another prisoner, which I was successful in doing on a number of occasions, in a number of ways, you were invariably tortured, and they usually extracted some kind of thing that you didn't want them to, such as saying, "I'm sorry to Ho Chi Minh that I violated the camp regulations," or whatever.
I have a quote from your book here that says, "Those not subject to the prisoner of war experience may have trouble understanding how real was the presence of God to most of us. Our tapped conversations, your method of communicating, almost always ended with GBU, God bless you. And at night, the final exchange between men and adjacent cells would be GNGBU, good night, God bless you." That was not just your experience, but apparently it was something shared by many of the men that were in confinement.
For those who were there for the principal period of time, I would say 90% of those who were in prison more than 3 years or 2 years, that was universally the case. Anyone who was in solitary confinement or tapping to the next cell, I would say 98% of them ended up at night with GNGPU and at the end of any conversation with GBU, yes.
Huh. The rest of that quote says, "Christians of all denominations lost old prejudices and found brotherhood. Christians and Jews were reconciled, and most of us lived with the awareness of God's love." Is that what got you through it, Senator?
Oh, there's no question about that. I would have died of despair in the first day in that prison had I been able to see 6 months ahead of what was going to happen. But you take things 1 second at a time. I can remember being in torture. If I could see a clock, I would say, "Okay, Lord, let me last a minute." And then I would finally see that minute hand achieve that gap between 1 minute mark and the next. I'd say, "Lord, give me 2. Lord, give me 5. Lord, give me 10. Lord, give me 15. And sometimes you could go 4 days like that, and that would be between intervals of unconsciousness and then renewed consciousness. And it's remarkable. I saw, you say you consider me a hero. I saw many. I saw a young man, many whom I would call heroes. I saw a young man kept in a place where they had kept cattle. It was like a garage with a double door. He had a broken arm. He was in irons, leg irons, sitting up, one arm held up in the air in the cast. And I got beat up pretty badly one night whistling patriotic songs to him to let him know I was near. I could see him out through a crack in my door. But that kind of heroism was commonplace and is commonplace. What I find frustrating and indeed tragic is you're saying, and people believing, that there aren't many heroes around today. I have seen so many young people from, say, 12 to their mid-20s show me more heroism in the true sense of that word in the last few years than I ever saw on the football field, in the air, or in prison.
Tell us about the night that you used your eyes to blink the word torture on videotape.
Well, it was my second torture session. It was May of 1966. I had been tortured in January of that same year to give a biography, which was an absurd biography, but nonetheless, I didn't like being forced to write anything besides name, rank, serial number, date of birth. This time, they tortured me for what they called a confession. And they hurt me pretty bad, and I wrote some things and said some things that constituted to them good enough to let me off the hook from further torture. My confession, I'm sure, to them was useless, but nonetheless, it made me feel bad that I said more than name, rank, date of birth, etc. So they kept me up three nights after that immediate torture, which I was unconscious from for, perhaps 8 hours. They kept me up three nights in a row telling me what to say at this interview and saying that I was going to be tortured again if I disobeyed them. I had talked with Robbie Reisner about this, a colonel in the Air Force, before I went. They had told me what was going to happen, and we had whistled and Morse code back and forth with one another. And I said, Robbie, I don't know what to do. If I go in there and don't do what they tell me, I'm afraid if they torture me, they might really get something useful from me if I be tortured again, because I'm at the end of my rope. And yet I just don't see how I can in conscience go in there and do what they want me to. So he just advised me to pray on it. So I did a lot of praying. And as I went in the room, I'd made up my mind a few hours before I went in that for whatever it was worth, I was going to say the opposite of the things they wanted me to. And for example, they asked me a question after haranguing me with how much bombing of churches, schools, and hospitals our government had done. How could I go along with such a policy? And my answer was to the effect that I don't know what the policy of my government is, because the only sources of information I have are North Vietnamese newspapers, magazines, radio. But whatever that policy is, I support it, and I will support it as long as I live. I never gave any indication that I believed anything they said. In fact, I implied that they were liars with their propaganda. The Japanese who got that information, he was a Japanese photographer who had been taping scores of confessions, knew he had a scoop because he knew we'd all been tortured. And the others were getting routine, and this was the first one in which someone had just flown in their face. So he escaped from North Vietnam and went back to Japan, and I understand sold it for $50,000 to, I believe, ABC. The Navy intelligence people caught the word torture, which I chose to blink in the light of
with your eyes, you blinked
my eyes.
The Morse
code. As they asked me questions, I blinked the word torture over and over again, which is sort of like, you know, patting your head and rubbing your stomach, and would require more coordination than I was normally capable of. And it's another example of an answer to a prayer. If
who
you think
picked
about
that up,
it,
Senator? Who saw it?
Some guys in Naval Intelligence. I don't know who. But Navy Intelligence did pick it up, and that was the first indication they had officially that we were tortured, although even Time magazine had assumed and printed that they assumed we were because of the way the torture confessions were worded and the way the guys looked.
So you were in solitary confinement for 4 years. How'd you get the word that you were being released?
Well, I was in solitary confinement
for 7 years. Which
yeah,
seven
so
and
it's
half.
You know it's again. Yeah.
Long story.
Yeah, but the word that we were to be released came through their own public address system in 1972, December. But we knew that it was coming because the B-52 bombings and the strategic bombings around North Vietnam, particularly around Hanoi, and the mining of Haiphong Harbor, the strategic bombings over around Haiphong, broke the enemy's will. And we were right in the middle of it there in Hanoi. And it was quite a sensational thing to see groups of 80, strings of 80 aircraft, B-52s at a time, coming over, each B-52 carrying more than the usual whole flight of tactical airplanes that had been dropping by there all through the war.
What year was that?
Well, the bombing was in December 1972. I think the actual peace agreement was written in about the second week of January of 1973.
What was it like to walk out of prison after 7.5 years, not knowing how your family was doing, not knowing if you would survive a month or two? What was it like to be free and to come home a hero?
Well, I didn't know I was coming home a hero. My wife told me on the phone I was a hero, and I didn't even pause, except 9 days, let's see, before I was released, I was permitted to mix, as was everyone else, with the rest of the prisoners for the first time in my case. And one of them, Red McDaniel, came up to me and said, hello, and he said, gee, Jerry, that was magnificent, as if he knew what I was talking about. I said, what was magnificent, Red? And he said, that time, you blinked torture. And I had been hearing different versions of that because people had a vague memory of seeing other prisoners interviewed, and I had nightmares that they had dubbed words into my mouth, yeah. And although they might have caught the torture, first of all, I thought they'd burn the film. But then I started interrogating our guys when they'd come in and said, did you ever see a guy on television? Did you ever see anybody blinking? And all? And Red said, well, yeah, they did. They picked up the torture, and they had you saying the right thing, defying the Vietnamese government, and they used as a model in the POW school up there. That was the first indication that I had gotten by. I didn't consider that heroic. I just considered that at least they hadn't ruined me. They hadn't destroyed my sense of honor back home or the honor of my family. As far as my family is concerned, I knew something about it. They had permitted me to get a letter from my wife about 6 months after I was in prison. Then about 8-10 months later, I got another one. Then eventually, we started getting 5 lines a month, except sometimes it skipped 3 or 4 months, and if you're in trouble, you wouldn't get any. The 5 lines were rather cryptic. We were permitted to write 5 lines back after 2 or 3 years, so I had some idea.
Yeah. You had 2 sons that had gotten married since you
That's right.
went
I
off
had,
to war.
Out of my 7 children, when I left, one was about 18 months, the youngest, and the eldest boy was about a junior going into senior year of high school. Hmm. When I came home, they were 7 years, 7 months older than that.
Where were you reunited with your family?
After 3 days of brief hospital treatment and some debriefing, as they called it. They took some men from the first 3 airplanes, which came back that same day I did, put them in another plane, and we led the others home, as it were. We landed in the Honolulu, and then we landed at San Francisco, and they let me be the spokesman those 2 times. And after, as we started across the country, I told Chappie James, the 4-star general, who's a friend of mine, that I wasn't going to do any more talking at all, because he was telling me I was going to be on the Today Show, the Tomorrow Show, the Night Show, and all that. And I said, you got the wrong guy, Chappie. I said,
for a guy who's been sitting in a room for 4 years.
I said, get some of the other guys to say something. I said, and give each, I made him promise he would give each of the remaining 2/3 of the prisoners who were not yet released, we were released in 3 increments, the same degree of attention we got in that first group. He did, and the country did, and so I was satisfied.
Senator, having been kept in prison longer than any other American POW in the history of our country, you were gone some 7.5 years. You came home in 1973. A lot of changes took place in our country between 1965 and 1973. What did you observe, and how did those changes hit you?
I felt relatively shocked, to put it mildly. I remember leaving the airport about 3 o'clock in the morning at Virginia Beach and being driven with my wife to the Naval Hospital, where we underwent a number of checks. I noticed all these X-rated movies, which I'd never heard of. I saw the massage parlors, which I thought had gotten extremely popular without knowing why. Huh. And then as I read the newspapers and saw what was on the newsstand, even in the hospital, the Naval Hospital, I realized what a revolutionary change had occurred in America's sort of mores in their perception of what America was. I always had it as one nation under God, at least trying to earn that. And I thought of it that way in prison. I thought about the fact that we differed from the communists in several major ways. First, we did believe in God. They didn't. They have atheism as their principal state tenet. We have the belief in God with the utmost reliance, providence, etc. in God we trust, all of those things. The second, we believe in family. They believe in commune, theoretically. Free enterprise, they go for the opposite. State allocation of resources to the people, and the price is all fixed, and all that sort of thing. And then our international orientation is the opposite of theirs. They want world conquest. We, at worst, are apathetic, and at best, altruistic. I think we have as good a record as anyone who ever came down the pike. And then lastly, the citizen's relationship with the government is, and the government's attitude toward the citizen, the opposite in the two systems. But the family aspect of it, for example, had changed tremendously in the United States as I got home, and I thought that the institution of the family was going to be in dire trouble with the so-called sexual revolution, and still do, and consider it one of the most pressing survival issues of our day. I happened to see your Where is Dad program in the Senate there, and I was extremely impressed by it. And it waked me up, because as I'll show you the letters that I have with me still. I've written most of my children. All of my children have a copy of a letter I wrote to one, which says words to the effect that I apologize because I recognize that having come home and in with these resolutions that I made in prison, most of which dealt with national, international affairs and extremely personal, unilaterally personal matters, such as, you know, I'm going to be a good man from now on, but not with the family, that I had reached out to the family in the national sense, but I had taken for granted my own family. And I promised them in that letter that from now on I would write each one of the immediate members of my family or call them every week, and every 2 weeks call or write every member of my extended family. So I intend to be as attentive to my family personally as I have been to the issue nationally.
Senator, thanks for being a friend of the family in Washington, and thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Jim.
Whoa-wee, Dad. We have been listening to former POW and United States Senator Admiral Jeremiah Ditton describe his time as a 7.5-year prisoner of war during Vietnam. And you can see why he's been so decorated with 3 Silver Stars, 2 Purple Hearts, and just a trunk load of other awards. You know, Luann and Dad, this makes me think of Lincoln. He will grow up having no actual knowledge of the Vietnam War. It will be only what the media tells him it was, and I want him to hear this when he's old enough. And I'll bet there's someone listening now that says, this is a hero. This is a role model. If you want a copy of this, you can call us, you can write us, and we would love to send you this so that you can teach the next generation about true American heroes.
Yeah, isn't it disturbing that the younger generation does not know about the heroes out there that bought their freedom? Now, they're not going to get it in school. I'm sorry to say, and that'll irritate some people, but in many schools there would be nothing said about Vietnam. You just think of the men who paid this price and who suffered in many other ways, and the 58,000 that died. This story is one that ought to be heard by everybody.
That's right.
Well, Doctor, it's also a great reminder of the redemptive nature of God. I mean, this gentleman who had horrific war experiences came back, capped it off with service in the U.S. Senate, where he actually ironically heard a portion of your original film series, Where's Dad, but used all of that to play together to further deepen his commitment to his own family.
You know, listening again to my interview with Admiral and then Senator Denton embarrassed me because I'd been doing a radio program for just 6 years or so. And I didn't match the emotion of what he was saying there at the end. Well, thank you, Senator, for all that you've done. It didn't capture what I feel now, which is deep appreciation. What he said about my film series, frankly, was also very meaningful to me. Now, what he was talking about is the third film from the 7-film series called Focus on the Family. And it was distributed distributed throughout Congress by Congressman Frank Wolf from Virginia. Congressman Tom DeLay found the Lord, or at least rededicated himself to the Lord, having watched this very film. So 80 million people saw that series, which is very gratifying to
me. And that's why we are remastering it together this summer. There's a whole generation that hasn't seen it. It's amazing. I love it. I shared it with all my friends and finally brought it to you and said, we need to redo this. We need to remaster it, let people see this again, because it helps me as a father, helps me as a husband, helps me as a man of God.
Well, Ryan, you do get some things right. That's one of them.
And again, if you're interested in getting your very own CD copy of Admiral Denton's message, myfamilytalk.com, or give us a call, 1-877-732-6825, 877-732-6825.